Now Bill Resnick talks to Paul Fenn, who drafted the legislation now in effect in Massachusetts, Iowa, California, Illinois, New Jersey, New York, Rhode Island, and Virginia. Collectively, they serve about 5% of Americans in over 1,300 municipalities. These enactments authorize communities to take over the electricity supply responsibility from the local investor-owned utility, or IOU. Bill and Paul also discuss how community energy agencies operate on a day-to-day basis and why, though under attack now by the IOUs, they are still expanding because of their many virtues, offering more reliable, less expensive, and greener sun and wind energy to the cities.
Hi, Paul Fenn. Welcome to KBOO.
Thank you, Bill. It's a pleasure to be here.
Paul Fenn is one of the most important people. He's made significant contributions to all of us who inhabit the planet. But he's one of the most important people you never heard of, because he was the thinker and doer, the innovator, who brought to life, first in Massachusetts in 1995, and then around the country, brought to life one of the most important innovations of the 20th century. For Paul Fenn, at age 25, drafted the legislation that authorized community energy. In Massachusetts, the legislation is called Community Choice Aggregation, as it is in California. But whatever the name, these enactments authorize the creation of public community agencies with the power to replace the corporate utilities in serving the electricity needs of their community, and to replace it with mostly clean, green, sun and wind technologies. The many existing community energy cities in Massachusetts, over 150 cities, including Boston, who have just begun, they are proving to be the quickest and least expensive means of ending the grave, in fact, existential threat of man-made climate change. In addition, community energy creates the possibility of a far more healthy, democratic, sustainable, more fulfilling societies for all its members. That's a big claim. We're going to prove it. So, Paul Fenn, tell us the story of the legislation, how you came to draft it in Massachusetts, and why the time was right for it.
I was, a guy caught in a situation. I was in graduate school in early 90s, and I happened to have a friend who told me about his professor, who, it turns out, became famous for the economic theories behind basically carbon trading, the idea of carbon trading. That is the idea that we can reduce carbon by trading permits to pollute. And this is the dominant kind of policy paradigm of U.S. climate policy, really, since then. This professor, his name is Ronald Coase, a British economist, had come up with a theory in the 1950s. I thought it was just such a horrifying notion, because I was studying intellectual history and specifically propaganda, Nazism, things like that. And so the idea of carbon credits to me were reminiscent of that kind of abuse of language that you would say as a matter of policy, that we will sell the right to pollute the atmosphere and then we'll allow the owners of those rights to trade them. And that struck me as just utterly dystopian. So I confronted this professor in a humorous way, and he supported me, and in fact, he told me that I was right, and that his theory, which was kind of old by then, was wrong, and it was all going to be worked out in the restructuring of the energy industry, and that this was going to be coming up to the United States. So he knew all these things. He was still a professor at the University of Chicago in the Department of Economics, and I knew nothing about any of these things, nor did I care about them, frankly. But I thought, here's an opportunity. He said it would start in Massachusetts and then move to California. Well, I'm from California, and my wife is from Massachusetts. And at the time, her uncle, actually her step-uncle, was the governor of Massachusetts. And in fact, he just left. And so I thought, I have to do something about this. It was really just this seeing the opportunity that I could jump into early phase of the discussion about climate policy in this, what Coase, Ronald Coase, this economist, said was the central arena for working out what he called the relationship between the government and marketplace. So I was very interested in studying the crises of capitalism and communism, and I was very interested in the possibility of other economic theories, and really was viewing climate change as a really good test case for an economic theory. And then electric industry restructuring became this very targeted, specific opportunity to try to articulate something. So I used my connections to get a position in the Massachusetts Senate. I was the director of the Senate Energy Committee, the Senate half of a joint committee on energy. the state legislature, and which put me in charge of writing the legislation for the committee. And little known to anyone, really, I was putting together this idea because it wasn't really desired by anyone. There was no one asking for this bill. In fact, most were opposed to the idea because there were other ideas that were in circulation, namely the sort of Enron idea of just deregulate everything versus the old monopoly idea, which is let us keep controlling everything. And this was very much a third course for which there was no existing constituency. So at first it just seemed like a wild dash by a graduate student to throw something in the mix, really thinking of it more as an act of literature than as anything that would succeed. So I was very surprised to find, ultimately, when it did become law in Massachusetts, I laughed. I couldn't believe it.
Somebody must have promoted it in the legislature. What was going on at the time in 1995 where a majority of the legislature would vote for a law that gave communities the power to take over from the investor-owned utilities? How is it that it, in fact, passed the legislature and was enacted around the country in several states? In fact, I think you were central to that.
Yeah, I was. I worked on it, well, since then, right? But, in fact, I still work on legislation now in states that are thinking about it. I've written bills for a number of states. But, yeah, it's a really interesting story and something I love to tell people because it's one of the main insights or lessons, I guess, for me of having gone through it was realizing this fact that I don't think is widely enough realized, because we live in this very top-down political system where we view ourselves as having no power, and we participate in national elections with this hope that we'll get a great leader who will somehow change everything for us. The story of community choice aggregation, when it passed in the Cape, what we thought at the time was, because we were surprised ourselves, but to realize that municipalities as governments have a kind of quiet power in state legislatures. It's quiet because they're not as omnipresent as the energy companies, which have these permanent armies of lawyers that are always at the legislature and they know everyone and totally connected and often have been in and out of the government themselves. Municipalities are quieter. They just send their lawyer to a legislative hearing who makes usually a fairly blasé statement of policy by the municipality. But what we learned was when you get enough of those in a legislative hearing room, basically if you have more city attorneys in the room than you have utility attorneys, you win. Because they do have this upwardly projecting kind of centrifugal power, where the power of the local reaches up into the state and federal levels, specifically because the local politicians are colleagues of the state legislative members.
Sure. Yeah,
and they compete with them and they're allied with them. Exactly. And if they get mad at them, then they run against them. And so they don't want to fight. And so if there's enough local governments appearing, and particularly what I learned was local governments in the jurisdictions of the committee members, for example, of the energy committee or the affected committee in the legislature, that's very persuasive to the voting behavior of a committee.
How did you convince the city attorneys and the mayors, apparently, or the city managers, that this wacky idea, basically having the city take over the energy supply, how did you convince them of that, especially since the big utilities have so many lawyers and lobbyists and make charitable contributions in every city trying to curry support? How did you manage to get all these city attorneys on your side?
That is really another really interesting question, and which I will attempt to answer. I think it's the next layer, right? There's the one layer, which is the power of that the local has once it's expressed at the state level, which is in many ways profound. The second is, you know, how do you get that city attorney to appear? I have never persuaded a city attorney of anything because they can't be persuaded by a member of the public, right? And nor have I ever really persuaded a city council member of very much, because local elected officials as well as state tend to be the extroverted types that don't really follow rational reasoning. So other than the rational counting of things like contributions and votes and so on, but not what's a good idea, we should do that good idea. That's almost never happened to me in my career, almost never. There's never that level of attention given to ideas in politics. And so it's really just a seduction process is how I like to describe it. It sounds a little exotic, but it has to do with how do you convince someone that something is a good idea without them having to commit anything in advance. And the answer is, first ask them, do you think you should be allowed to do this? Not do you think you should become a community choice aggregator, but do you think you should be allowed to become a community choice aggregator? That's a really easy question to answer yes to. And that's really what I asked. And so I prepared resolutions for city councils to adopt where they said they should be allowed to. They didn't say that they were going to do it. And when I first got those resolutions adopted, they're very easy to get adopted because they don't commit anything. Resolutions are essentially statements of opinion. But what they do, importantly, is they give you a document to bring to the state legislators from those districts to convince them to pay attention to you. And so now someone who would never listen to an idea wants to know what you're doing because they're getting pressure from their competitors. It's that kind of math that really drives the bargain. And so the city attorneys appear downstream. Now, here's how it works, really, in my experience, is I get that resolution, which was easy to get because you just need someone to sponsor it and it doesn't commit anything. Local governments love to adopt a resolution that doesn't commit action. So it's really easy. It takes about 2 weeks to a month to pass a resolution. And then so I would get, you know, a dozen of those or so. In Massachusetts, we actually got 30. And in California, I got, I don't know what it was, 40 or something resolutions, and brought them to the legislature with the bill and found a sponsor because of the resolutions, basically. Now, what happened immediately when you get a sponsor in the legislature is the sponsor begins to be lobbied by the utilities to gut the bill. And so there commences a process where the sponsor should be sharing with you these requests to gut. And of course, when they're shared with you, you then share them with the municipal officials that pass the resolution. So they learn that the utilities are now maneuvering to prevent them from having the right to do what they said they should have a right to do. And now you've engaged a public official in an issue that they care about for the first time. Because when someone tries to block a politician, that is a personal offense. And so for the first time, really, at that moment, they want to become CCAs. It's like the Tom Sawyer trick with the white fence on a certain level.
They also respond, it seems to me, politicians, to sort of the zeitgeist, the way the people are coming to think, to the values that are being expressed. And my guess is that your resolutions had to be supported by community people and seen as a way of getting out from under the very expensive and sort of authoritarian corporate model and corporate control. My guess is, at least in Massachusetts and California at that time, the people did not oppose it. My guess is that it seemed like something that should be tried. And I think partly because of the unpopularity of the Enron model, especially then.
Yes. Enron, the Enron crisis created a permanent opening for CCA around the turn of the century. Up until that time, it was different because public opinion was basically asleep on the subject of climate and energy in the 1990s. But the crisis, as well as obviously the climate crisis slowly coming onto public opinion, have changed that. And the battles that occurred also helped. So the utilities in California tried to block the local governments from doing these things. And those battles became very front page news for a number of years. And that raised consciousness as well. But I think there is an important idea there that you mentioned, that particularly with climate change, but also with a lot of ecological epiphanies of our time, there's a lot more, in a sense, people are ahead in their thinking of the government. The government is sort of backward. The governing class is more backward. So the people are more radical than the government on the subject of climate change. And activism was a major part of CCA. I mean, the reason that we could get all these people in the room was that activists were working on it to get these resolutions, and they could see the angle. So it's a very compelling idea for people who had been trapped in conventional energy policy, which are things like how to get cheaper power for consumers and more energy efficiency and more renewable energy, but not the kinds of ideas that now are in circulation, such as climate emergency, right? So thinking is changing a lot, and the government's being dragged along in that process. But activists are what made this happen.
This is Bill Resnick for The Old Mole talking to Paul Fenn. He wrote the legislation that brought community energy to birth in 1995 in Massachusetts. He's fought for community energy ever since. Paul Fenn, the big corporate utilities, as we discussed, are very powerful, supported even by the banking industry, who make great sums underwriting the corporate utility debt and their bond offering. They've made great efforts to stop cities and states from creating community choice laws. We'll hear from you next week, Monday, on This Old Mole Show in part two of our interview. Yet with all the IOU money and effort, community choice keeps growing in the states where they are authorized, and communities, cities, in some cases counties, particularly in California, groups of counties, they fight to keep them. The utilities are constantly trying to destroy them in the public utility commissions of the state and the legislature, too. In California and other states, they've run initiative campaigns, which have usually lost, although the IOUs have, in fact, captured some legislatures who have limited community energy or destroyed it. But the cities themselves who have it, my sense is that people support them and protect them and don't want to return to be served by the corporate utilities. Tell us, why is that? What are the virtues of community energy that maintain support for it?
It is really the core of the economy, and it is to climate change what the suburban mall is to global labor exploitation, right? It is the syringe of the global energy system. And so control over the energy sectors, electricity, natural gas, gasoline, diesel, constitutes really the whole driver of the globalizing system that we've lived in since World War II, specifically an American system. So it's very much sort of locked and loaded with the post-war order, so-called. And in some ways, you know, with the end of the Cold War, the base of that order disappeared. The need to have, the perceived need to have the military-industrial complex disappeared, and yet it didn't go away. And the energy industry that is essentially its handmaiden didn't go away either. All of these oil ships that follow the same naval highways as the military ships and all the supply chains that the military protects at sea, that's really two halves of one system. So I do think that there is a desire to disengage from that system by people and recognizing that always putting your money into the Shell or Chevron pump every day and putting your money into the fossil utility every month is a big part of the problem. And so trying to figure out how do you change this energy system, and in some ways it is a kind of, because we have state regulation of monopolies as the main market structure in the United States, again, post-war establishment system of a tight marriage of large corporations and government, it's a bit of a protection racket where the state regulators claim that they're trying to achieve all these sorts of benefits to deal with climate change and protect consumers and so on. But they're sort of like the priests with the conquistadors who try to protect the Indians while converting them. And so it's getting out of that protection racket, I think, is very appealing to a lot of Americans, just breaking out of the system. On the other hand, the Enron solution to the breakout, deregulation, essentially release them to the wolves, right? So they recognize that we need something other than just deregulation. And so the municipality comes into view as this really quite traditional principle of communities protecting their interests. I think it's non-controversial among the political parties for that reason, that it's not a centralized structure, it's a decentralized structure, and it gives autonomy and self-governance to communities, which also, in a sense, is non-controversial, even though some would call it radical. It's not really controversial. And that form of local authority over utilities, over public needs, it is very traditional. But specifically in the context of climate and energy, people do want meaningful climate action that they're not getting from state governments or the federal government, and they've never received it. But they also want protection from the energy market itself, because with climate change and with peak everything, there are these recurring cyclical crises in the energy sector that are extremely damaging to local economies and to local safety. And so there is increasingly a desire to get greater local control over energy and have less exposure to, for example, the price of gas, like what just happened in Texas, to have these insane shocks to the economy that occur because of a storm. That's all caused by overdependence on gas, for example, right? And most Americans are overdependent on gas. So when gas markets become unstable, you suddenly have energy bills that double, triple, and all of the energy sectors are hedged off of each other as a financial instrument. So you have basically the tracking of different energy commodities, and they all go up and down in relation to that volatility. So desire to solve climate change, desire to get some independence from the volatility of the energy market, disengage from the main cause of war worldwide. So all those three, I think, really motivate the transition to an energy democracy idea that is widely spoken of now, energy democracy. And I don't think people really know what they mean by that, but I think they know what they mean is that it should be local, that people should be able to be more participatory in their decisions about energy, not just receive multiple choice options from corporations and government. And that we need to have creativity and innovation, and we need to adapt to local needs and not just get cookie-cutter energy products from Corporation A, Corporation B.
Paul Fenn, it seems to me it's also a bread-and-butter issue that is, if community energy was a lot more expensive than going through the corporation, it seems to me that people would, because most people in the United States are strapped and energy bills actually add up, they would be much more interested in the investor-owned utilities, their efforts to, that people could be organized against the community energy. But my sense is now that in almost every case, and in California, the community energy people have shown themselves to be much cheaper, and they also, unlike the investor-owned utilities who talk about sun and wind and their commitment to it, but in fact, they don't care if they're doing oil or sun and wind, but they just don't want to strand their coal and gas assets. It's just they can't be paying the bonds on plants that are closed and not producing. So they at best can go very slowly towards removing their coal plants and gas plants and all the rest of it. And also because there are tremendous costs involved with the IOUs, particularly in the grid, building the grid and the whole apparatus. My sense is that the bread and butter issues are also important.
Definitely. That's the real driver, you know, that these community choice aggregations have uniformly saved consumers money and small consumers, and whether residential or businesses that in other markets don't receive benefits. So that's been really driven the growth of CCA to whatever it is now, 30 million Americans, because it saves people money. But what has really made the policy grow at an even faster rate recently is the idea that you could turn, not just pay less for your energy as a benefit to consumers, but that you could convert your monthly electric bill into equity, that you could repurpose the bill you pay every month for electricity and for heating, even for your cars, for your gasoline. By changing technologies, you could turn those into assets that essentially that you own, so that you're no longer in the sort of renter class in relation to really the main bill that you pay, right? The energy bills being the first bills that people pay in society because they just have to have that energy. It's the driving force. So the opportunity to no longer be just a consumer of energy, but to have local renewables at the neighborhood level and even have it at the building level and normalize that as an idea in energy, a different way of thinking about energy, a different way of relating to it economically, I think that's really what's driving the growth now, sort of from saving money on that, you know, percentage of discount per month, you know, 20 years ago to now the opportunity to not have energy bills someday, right, which is what happens when you put solar on the roof and you pay it off. Once it's paid off, then you don't have a bill. And that's wealth. That's a change from reducing poverty to creating wealth.
Paul Fenn, my sense is that community energy is popular and cities and the people in cities do not want to give it up because the community energy entities, the local entities, can work with groups on the ground who are seeking an alternative transport system, alternative agriculture, alternative city form. There's really sort of a change of consciousness happening in the United States. And my sense is that the entities who provide the energy in working with the transport people and the urban agriculture people and the people who urge energy conservation and use reduction. That, in fact, is an enormous plus for community energy because they can build those cultures where we're using a lot less and doing it a lot more cheaply. And, in fact, getting healthier because we're not getting the various kinds of pollution that fossil fuels create. I don't think we have time to talk about that, but maybe next week we can. Paul Finn, our apostle to renewable, clean sun and wind energy, local community energy. It was great to talk to you, and we'll continue next week.
Thank you, Bill. It's an honor. I truly enjoyed it.
Keep up the good work.